once. He saw how badly he'd blown the call. But instead of letting the dust settle in silence like so many of his colleagues, Joyce chose a different path. He walked straight to the Detroit Tigers' locker room and requested an audience with Galarraga. Face red as a tomato, tears in his eyes, he hugged Galarraga and managed to get out two words before dissolving into tears. Lo siento. He apologized boldly and unreservedly. In doing so, he changed sports history. There had been previous perfect games in baseball, but this was the first redemption game. There are many things that are common to us all. Birth, death, and a lifetime full of mistakes, errors, and gaffes. We all know this, and the vast majority of our mistakes, while temporarily frustrating and even maddening to others, are forgivable. Why then do we have such a hard time admitting them? Take Tiger Woods, for example. His Thanksgiving night car crash outside his home quickly triggered seemingly endless accusations and allegations of extramarital affairs. Where once rumors of affairs would be passed around town as unsubstantiated gossip, our digital age can broadcast, accuse, and convict almost overnight. Woods's response? A prepared, vague admission of his transgressions and a request for privacy. His professional and personal world soon collapsed around him. Sponsors dropped him, his wife left him, and his golf skills suffered greatly. Could he have taken a different road? Of course. In the first weeks of the breaking news, before the fallout of endorsement deals being canceled or Woods' wife's departure, PR experts pointed to a different approach that could have stopped the bleeding much sooner. In a Phoenix Business Journal article, journalist Mike Sunnix cited Abby Fink of HMA Public Relations. Fink said Woods and his camp chose silence over getting in front of a story that ended up being driven by TMZ and the National Enquirer. In the absence of anything coming from Tiger, the media will go find the sources elsewhere. And after today's news, it would appear that there are plenty of people willing to share their side of the story, Fink said. Troy Corder, a principal with Critical Public Relations in Phoenix, said the Woods camp made numerous mistakes, including essentially lying, hunkering down with a bunker mentality, and not being ready to respond to tabloid reports, which have been true in part. A sincere and swift apology, publicly made, would have brought him to earth in the right sort of way. He had been an untouchable icon. A quick and emphatic admission not only would have cleared the air, but also would have confirmed to people he was like all of us. Human, mistake-prone, and messy, something we all knew anyway. That would have only helped him return to others' good graces much sooner. Digital royalty CEO Amy Martin observed at the time, Tiger should humanize his brand via social media outlets, specifically with Twitter and real-time raw video. His Facebook presence has a polished and promotional tonality, leaving fans wanting a glimpse behind the scenes. If he had allowed people to see the person behind the superstar personality, perceptions and expectations could have been different in recent events. Unfortunately, it was not the road Tiger's team chose after the events that changed the course of his career, and the dust took much longer to settle. Such is the effect of ignoring this principle in the digital age. Negative news spreads faster than ever. If you've made a mistake, it is far better that you control the news being spread. Come clean quickly and convincingly. One reason we find it so difficult to admit our faults is that we are inclined to forget the messages that apologies bear. This forgetfulness is all the more dangerous today. If we admit our faults immediately and emphatically, it is like shooting a full-page press release across the wires that confirms we genuinely care about the people we hurt, that we are humbled, and that we want to make things right. People rarely hold on to anger and disappointment when they can see that we view ourselves and the situation properly. We are much more forgiving of those who are willing to come clean right away. Contrast the public's view today of baseball slugger Jason Giambi, who immediately and tearfully admitted steroid use as the scandal was coming to light, against former slugger Mark McGwire, who waited 5 years to clear the air. Giambi had his life back rather quickly. The public was gracious and quick to forgive. While McGwire certainly had his reasons for delaying his explanation, in many baseball fans' minds, he forever wears a scarlet S on his chest. A half decade after his stellar career ended, he still remained a long way off from receiving the Hall of Fame induction that was once a foregone conclusion. If we are aloof and ambiguous about our mistakes, we also shoot out a full-page press release, but one that reads, "I would like my life back." While we'd all like our pre-mistake lives back after a mistake has been made, we have to remember that no one changed the circumstances but us. It is not others' duty to give us back the life we took from ourselves. Only we can get our life back. That always begins with admitting our faults quickly and emphatically. What all of us at one time or another forget is that there is a certain degree of satisfaction in having the courage to admit one's errors. It not only clears the air of guilt and defensiveness, but also often helps solve the problem created by the error much quicker. Ronald Reagan was known as the Great Communicator because, to the joy of his supporters and the consternation of his critics, he could move from a place of defensive weakness to undeniable strength with a simple quip. One of his tried and true methods? An easy familiarity with the apology. During one particularly rocky patch of his presidency, he poked fun at his own White House, conceding, "Our right hand doesn't know what our far right hand is doing." Reagan knew it was easier to bear self-condemnation than condemnation from others. If we know we are going to be rebuked anyhow, isn't it better to beat the other person to the punch? When we recognize and admit our errors, the response from others is typically forgiveness and generosity. Quickly, the error is diminished in their eyes. It is only when we shirk responsibility or refuse to admit our errors immediately that we raise the ire of those around us, and the original misjudgment seems to grow in importance and negative effect. Today we have the opportunity to broadcast our apologies, to let everyone involved know we made an error and are sorry for it. We nip negative opinions in the bud when we take that action, and we gain people's respect, because it takes courage to admit our faults publicly. It also takes courage to admit our faults privately. Consider our families. How hard is it for husbands and wives to admit their mistakes to each other? It's akin to stabbing yourself in the gut. But no matter what that mistake may have been, it is crucial to choose the path of humility and rely on the power of forgiveness. Anne was a successful finance executive and mother of three. Honors graduate of an Ivy League school, she'd never really failed at anything. She married the man of her dreams, and then one night found herself hanging out with some of her buddies from work while at an out-of-town convention. One drink led to two, and two to four, and the group of buddies got smaller until it was just a male co-worker and her. They decided to leave the bar, and in the elevator, they kissed. A few more floors and footsteps later, and they stood outside her hotel room door. She opened it. They kissed again. Then they stopped. He backed away, and so did she. Each was married. They loved their spouses. They kissed again. And then they stopped, and he left, and the door closed behind him. Anne went to bed alone. And then woke up to the nightmare that she'd betrayed the man of her dreams. She went home 2 days later and said nothing for 6 years. It was a mistake. A one-time mistake with only one witness, who wasn't going to say anything either. The years passed with the memory locked away in a mental and emotional safe. She knew that if this secret got out, it would be the end of her life as the one who had it all together, the one who made no mistakes. But one evening, while on vacation, she told her husband everything. He looked at her and started crying. Of all the reactions she'd considered, that hadn't been one of them. Over the next several weeks, they talked to each other, to their friends, and to their pastor. Her husband grieved, and with every minute of his grief, her own heart broke. But something else broke as well, her mask of perfectionism. As friends learned of her mistake, she was overwhelmed by the very thing she never considered possible, grace and forgiveness. She discovered that the truth did indeed have the power to set her free. Anne's mistake was not without consequence, but in admitting the mistake and seeking forgiveness, she allowed room for a different perspective on her life, a perspective in which she was safe being imperfect. If only she had given herself room 6 years sooner. The same perspective exists for us all if we are brave enough to own it. Any fool can defend a mistake, and most fools do, but admitting your mistake raises you above the pack and gives you a feeling of exultation. At the end of 2010, people in the sports world engaged in that casual end-of-year discussion about whom Sports Illustrated would name as its Sportsman of the Year. The honor ended up going to New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees for leading the once hapless Saints to their first ever Super Bowl victory. It was a fitting selection. But Chris Harry of AOLNews.com believed two different men should have shared the prize instead. As far as sheer sportsmanship, to me, nothing compared to the fallout from the night of June 3rd. Harry goes on to recount the now famous story of the blown perfect game and concludes, "About 16 hours later, the Tigers and Indians played again, but the meeting that mattered came before the game when Galarraga was tabbed for the trip to home plate to turn in the lineup card. Joyce was waiting for him. The two exchanged handshakes and hugs in one of the most inspiring, emotional, and moving displays of sportsmanship any sport had ever seen. It was a moment worthy of being relived and helped us learn a lesson about invoking class and dignity when circumstances very easily, especially in this day and age, could have brought about a very different reaction." Oh, the power of two words to change everything. Lo siento. I'm sorry. Chapter 4. Begin in a friendly way. "Successful leaders are always initiators," writes leadership expert John C. Maxwell in his flagship book, The 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. He then recalls an instance where beginning in a friendly way was not only necessary, but highly recommended. Still a young man, he had been hired to take over the leadership of a troubled church in Lancaster, Ohio, where he was told a large and intimidating man named Jim Butts, the elected lay leader of the congregation, was the most influential person in the organization. He was also told Jim had a reputation for maverick behavior that at times had led the church down the wrong path. The first thing Maxwell did was arrange a meeting with Jim in his office. It could have been an awkward or even grossly misperceived moment, a 25-year-old rookie summoning the 65-year-old patriarch to meet with him, but Maxwell dispelled that notion immediately. The second Jim sat down, Maxwell began a humble acknowledgement of the situation. Jim was the influencer in the church, and Maxwell wanted to work with him, not against him. Maxwell then suggested they meet once a week for lunch to talk through the issues and make decisions together. "While I'm the leader here," said Maxwell, "I'll never take any decision to the people without first discussing it with you. I really want to work with you. We can do a lot of great things together at this church, but the decision is yours." When he finished, Maxwell explains, Jim didn't say a word. He got up from his seat, walked into the hall, and stopped to take a drink at the water fountain. I followed him out and waited. After a long time, he stood up straight and turned around. I could see that tears were rolling down his cheeks. And then he gave me a great big bear hug and said, "You can count on me to be on your side." Friendliness begets friendliness. We are more inclined to agree with another person or see things from his perspective when we have friendly feelings toward him. If, in contrast, we feel a person is busy or brusque or uninterested in sharing a common courtesy, we tend to mirror the sentiment. This is a difficult obstacle to overcome whether you've just met the person or have known him a while. Where the initiation of interactions is concerned, no approach sets the tone more effectively than gentleness and affability, even if the other person is a source of pain, frustration, or anger. A friendly greeting says, "You are worth my time. You are valuable." This subtle message has tremendous power, more than most realize. In The Seven Arts of Change, author David Shaner shares an incredible experience that taught him the immense power of beginning in a friendly way. He had been recruited by a longtime friend to teach Ki Aikido at the Aspen Snowmass Academy of Martial Arts just up the road from Pitkin County, a Colorado locale made famous in 1970 when American journalist Hunter S. Thompson ran for sheriff on the freak ticket, promoting the decriminalization of drugs for personal use, turning asphalt streets into grassy meadows, banning buildings that obscured the mountain view, and renaming Aspen Fat City to deter investors. Thompson narrowly lost the election that year, but his sentiment set the stage for another, less controversial, but equally unconventional man to become sheriff. His name was Dick Keenest, whose campaign poster had cited Cicela Bock's vision of societal values. Trust is a social good to be protected just as much as the air we breathe or the water we drink. Keenest believed civility and compassion should rule all law enforcement interaction, whether it involved violent felons or frustrated traffic offenders. "It was a momentous change initiative," writes Shaner, "and one that many thought foolish and unnecessary. Nevertheless, he moved forward in confidence." Among Shaner's first Ki Aikido students at Aspen Snowmass Academy were Sheriff Keenest and his deputies. Bob Broaddus was one of Keenest's key deputies and would go on to succeed him as Pitkin County Sheriff. Before then, Deputy Broaddus would establish his legacy with a compelling display of beginning in a friendly way. Broaddus was an imposing presence and fit the stereotype of a brawny, no-nonsense cop. This presence served as a stark and effective contrast to his demeanor with people. He never raised his voice, even in the midst of volatile situations. One event serves as a case in point. While Deputy Broaddus was the patrol director, a dispatch came through that an armed man was holding all the patrons hostage at a local restaurant called the Woody Creek Tavern. Broaddus was the first to arrive on the scene, and from outside the building he was apprised of the situation. The man's estranged wife was prohibiting him from visiting his daughter, whom he had seen in the restaurant. Rather than attempting a peaceful greeting, something clicked inside the man. He yanked out a gun and forced everyone inside to comply with his wishes. Deputy Broaddus assessed the danger and took a different tack. He peacefully approached the window unarmed. Sensing the deputy's affability, the gunman allowed him to enter the building. Broaddus then proceeded to address the man in a civil manner, asking him to consider the consequences of his actions, which could ultimately lead him to never seeing his daughter again. Bob's placid demeanor, his rational discussion of the real issues, and his empathy toward the man's rage validated the suspect, writes Shaner. And the more the man talked with Bob, the more he realized that much of his anger was with himself. He eventually put down his weapon. The man's whole demeanor then changed. Bob explained that exiting the tavern with cuffs on would put all the law enforcement people outside the tavern at ease so that neither Bob nor the suspect would run the risk of being shot. The man complied, and the conflict was ended peacefully. Consider this story the next time you sit down to write an email to somebody who has made you frustrated or angry. Will you begin with a civil, courteous tone, or let your emotions take over and jump into conflict? Will you take a few moments to inquire about the other person's life or work situation, or to create a bond through some shared interest by telling them something about yourself? If you begin in a friendly manner, you are far more likely to get the positive results you seek, especially if you and the other person are currently at odds. "I do not like that man," Abraham Lincoln once said. "I must get to know him better." If you believe building a friendly rapport will be critical to achieving a certain outcome, using texts, chats, or other short forms of communication isn't likely to get you very far. Because of the limited space and the lack of intonation and nonverbal cues to support your sentiment, it's very difficult to create the level of communication necessary to convey affability. If face-to-face is not possible, at least use a medium that will allow time and space to convey a level of friendliness that in Carnegie's time ruled human relations. It takes creativity and a bit more time to replicate the effect of a warm smile and a firm handshake, but it can be done. Social media requires that business leaders start thinking like small-town shop owners, concurs entrepreneur Gary Vaynerchuk, who wrote The Thank You Economy. This means taking the long view and avoiding short-term benchmarks to gauge progress. In short, business leaders are going to have to relearn the ethics and skills our great-grandparents' generation used in building their own businesses and took for granted. Only the companies that can figure out how to mind their manners in a very old-fashioned way and do it authentically are going to have a prayer of competing. There was an age when people left their houses in their best attire and said hello to all they passed on the way to work, when a meeting meant meeting, and when a call meant paying someone a visit rather than using the phone. While our transactions span the globe today, making such tangible connection more infrequent, it is still key to treat others in the same spirit you would if they were before you. Of his growing wine empire, Vaynerchuk explains, "We talk to every single individual as though we're going to be sitting next to that person at his or her mother's house that night for dinner." It's the proper perspective because it places the burden of accountability squarely where it should be, on the messenger's shoulders. The mistake many make today is placing the burden of accountability on the recipient of the message. We use the responses and reactions of others as the only gauge of whether we have taken the right approach or made the right impression. This is a slippery slope on two fronts. First, it can lead to laziness in considering motive's role in effective connection. If garnering a great response is the only measure of connection, then we easily become mere entertainers, provocateurs, and product pimps who think only about the next great gimmick to grab people's interest. Shock value is worth little where true connection is concerned. Second, responses can be deceptive, especially in the beginning. A tweet may garner many retweets, but this does not mean that those relaying your message to others have become fans or even friends. They may be thinking of someone else who might benefit from the message or might want to consider the product. Worse, they may have in mind someone who would laugh alongside the retweeter at your lack of knowledge, sincerity, or tact. An online marketing campaign might generate a spike in site traffic or a print media campaign lots of journalistic buzz, but wise business people know this does not mean relationships are being formed. There's a big difference between engagement and interest. Interest is piqued in a number of ways, many of which are less than genial. It often begins and ends on a superficial level because the primary emotions tapped are curiosity, surprise, or disgust. Engagement occurs on a deeper level when a person's core values are tapped. Common to all core values is the notion of being considered worthy of relationship. When you engage another in a friendly manner, you convey to him he is someone worthy of friendship, someone whom you'd like to call friend. It is for this reason, he who sows courtesy reaps friendship. If you want your voice to reach through the noise and beneath the surface to others' motives for moving in your direction, begin in a friendly way. The first impression that makes is far more memorable than anything the loudest or most provocative attention grabber on the planet could come up with. Years ago, when Carnegie was a barefoot boy walking through the woods to a country school in northwest Missouri, he read a fable about the sun and the wind. It serves as a vivid reminder of the power of this principle of earning others' trust. The sun and wind debated about which was the stronger, and the wind said, "I will prove I am. See the old man down there with a coat? I bet I can get his coat off him quicker than you can." So the sun went behind a cloud, and the wind blew until it was almost a tornado, but the harder it blew, the tighter the old man clutched his coat to him. Finally, the wind calmed down and gave up, and then the sun came out from behind the clouds and smiled kindly on the old man. Presently, the man mopped his brow and pulled off his coat. The sun then reminded the wind that gentleness and friendliness were always stronger than fury and force. It's a timely lesson in an age that appears to divvy rewards based on greatest volume, speed, and splash. Such rewards mean little in the long run because engagement that engenders longevity is continually authenticated on mutual benefit and trust. If you don't establish a foundation for both from the beginning through a friendly sentiment, both become more difficult to secure with each passing day. Wait too long or take too many shallow shots at attention, and you'll be left trying to talk the other into a relationship. It's never the place you want to be, begging for commitment. Engagement has to be heartfelt, writes Vaynerchuk, or it won't work. You cannot underestimate people's ability to spot a soulless, bureaucratic tactic a million miles away. It's a big reason why so many companies that have dipped a toe in social media waters have failed miserably. Winning friends begins with friendliness. Chapter 5. Access Affinity. Like, friend, follow, share. In the digital age, affinity often exists before we share the first hello. In Carnegie's time, friendship and commonality walked hand in hand. You met, you talked, you found common ground, and with it, a fondness that led to deeper friendship. Today, people follow you on Twitter or belong to the same Facebook group or like your latest video on YouTube before you ever meet. Often, there are numerous threads of affinity before you actually meet. With the particulars of what we like and dislike, digital buttons and thumbs up included, we give and are given permission to make agreements and disagreements based solely on affinity. We have points of affinity and points of dissonance, and more often than not, we gravitate and grant influence to those with whom we have the most in common. This can be a tremendous boost to building lasting relationships in which influence exists. We are not speaking of the law of attraction. You can think about having lots of friends with whom you have lots of influence, but nothing much will change if you don't take genuine, meaningful action to build those relationships. We are speaking of what author John C. Maxwell calls the law of magnetism. Effective leaders are always on the lookout for good people, he writes. Think about it. Do you know who you're looking for right now? What is your profile of perfect employees? What qualities do these people possess? Do you want them to be aggressive and entrepreneurial? Are you looking for leaders? Do you care whether they are in their 20s, 40s, or 60s? Now, what will determine whether the people you want are the people you get, whether they will possess the qualities you desire? You may be surprised by the answer. Believe it or not, what you get is not determined by what you want. It's determined by who you are. Like attracts like, in character and commonality. Today, however, we can have a head start. We can ascertain affinity before we approach a person. Liking serves in the digital age as a perfect door to influence. When someone joins the same Facebook group, follows your blog, or comments on a website, he or she is saying yes to you. That creates an intensely powerful position to hold if you want to influence that person. When a person says no, and really means it, a physiological cascade of reactions is taking place that is putting the person in a defensive position, ready to withdraw. But when this same person says yes and really means it, he is in a position of acceptance, of openness, of moving forward. So the more yeses you can get at the outset of an interaction, even if they have little to do with the ultimate proposal, the more likely you are to put the person in a mood to agree with you along the way. Getting to yes is so much easier if you start with yes. We have an obvious opportunity, a positive position from which to start dialogue. With the vast opportunities available to us to connect with the people who are interested in who we are and what we have to say, there is little excuse for starting a relationship or even a conversation on the wrong foot. More than that, organizations have the power to get their constituents saying yes based purely on the influence of the community. Microsoft understood this well when it released Windows 7. The computer giant had been dealt a blow with the exasperating launch of Windows Vista, a universally derided operating system. But it was ready to re-enter the fray with Windows 7, and it had learned from past experiences. It had to get its customers, its users, on board right from the start. It had to get them saying yes. First, it had to find its fans, the potential influencers in the community of PC users. In Empowered, authors Joseph Bernoff and Ted Shadler explore Microsoft's strategy for getting back in the ring. To combat the slick Mac versus PC commercials that depicted the PC as a nerdy, inefficient, outdated number cruncher, it solicited I'm a PC videos directly from users via a YouTube channel. It edited them together to create a powerful beginning to their yes-based marketing campaign. When it released a beta version of Windows 7 to targeted users, it trolled the feedback on blogs, Twitter, Facebook, discussion forums, and other social communities. In preparation for the market release, it created a moderated feed of the content posted on a host of other sites and platforms and presented the feed on its website, Facebook page, and elsewhere. It created advertising featuring users, highlighting the concept that Windows 7 was designed in part as a result of customer suggestions. The tagline, I'm a PC, and Windows 7 was my idea. The coup de grace, though, was how it got its fans to celebrate Windows 7 and to share it with others. It offered an opportunity to its fans. It made them feel important. If you were a Windows 7 fan, you could sign up to have a party in your home to show off the new features. Microsoft would send along materials. Word about the party opportunities spread through social media, and before long, tens of thousands of people in 14 countries had signed up. Microsoft estimates that the parties reached about 800,000 people, including hosts and guests. Considering how the release of Windows Vista had gone, PC users could have said no to Windows 7 right from the start, but Microsoft got them to say yes. When we start with yes at the most basic level, we are creating affinity. But to turn affinity into influence, there must remain a foundation of empathy. We must be able to constantly see the interaction from another's point of view so that we know the ultimate value of our points of affinity. Rather than use social media opportunities to help us start from yes and maintain that necessary commitment, we often ignore what it is that others want and bombard them with our pitch. Instead of getting them to say yes, yes, we force them to say stop, stop. Social media guru Chris Brogan calls it the blizzard of business rather than a communication snowfall. Conversations and relationships are based on several touches, he says. In the traditional marketing and communication world, people would use each touch to ask for something, to issue a call to action. This isn't how social networks work. They are there to give you permission to reach someone who has opted into a relationship with you. It's a snowfall. Every individual flake doesn't mean a lot, but the body of work can change everything. You have to offer them what they want in your communication if you want to begin and remain at yes. Only then have you earned a level of trust that permits you to confidently offer others your pitch, whether it is for a product, service, or cause. Of course, this principle is equally relevant and required outside of the digital realm. A newspaper company had a policy of delivering a new paper to customers who called to complain that their papers had been damaged by inclement weather. But over time, rising gas prices and fewer subscriptions made it financially impossible to maintain the practice. So they sent what they believed to be a very friendly letter to their customers. It began something like this. Dear valued customer, we will no longer deliver replacement newspapers when previously delivered newspapers have been damaged by weather. They went on to explain the change in policy, and then at the very end of the letter, they wrote this. If you do receive a damaged newspaper, please let us know, and we will refund the price of the newspaper on your next bill. The first response customers might have when reading this letter is irritation and protest. By the end of the letter, they're too worked up to care that an alternative, and possibly a better one, is being offered. What if, instead, the company had written the letter as follows? Dear valued customer, we recognize how frustrating it can be when the paper you receive is damaged due to the weather. Yes, it is. You pay for a product and service and expect quality in both areas. Yes, I do. Consequently, we will now offer a full refund for any paper you receive that has been rendered unreadable because of the weather. Really? Great. We also wanted to make you aware that, like you, our business has been affected by rising gas prices. Consequently, we will no longer be able to offer to deliver replacement papers. Just call us, and you will receive a refund instead. Oh, okay. At the very least, customers might have viewed the actions of the company in a much more favorable light. Today, there are two kinds of agreement. We need to keep both in mind where our interactions are concerned. The first kind of agreement is the common variety. It is the sort that surrounds two parties holding the same opinion on a particular issue. The presumption with this kind of agreement is that they were engaged at one time in a dialogue in which they uncovered their harmony of opinion. For most of us, this sort of dialogue-based agreement is the only kind of agreement we consider. But there is another kind of agreement that was far less feasible during Carnegie's time, but has become all the more important today. This second kind of agreement is based on two parties liking the same thing, or as we might view it, being similar people. We don't typically call this sort of harmony an agreement, but in the digital age, it is best to think of it as such, because we are always drawn to those with whom we have something in common. Establishing this commonality or affinity at the outset is a new form of yes. The more early yeses you possess, the more likely you are to succeed in capturing a yes to your idea, solution, or transaction. Access affinity as early and often as possible. Chapter 6. Surrender the Credit. A Dale Carnegie training student in Australia relayed the following story, which serves as a good lesson for what can happen when we ignore this principle. My business partner and I operated one of the largest IT retailers in Brisbane. We had 8 stores, employed more than 60 staff members, and had a turnover of more than $10 million per year. Although my business partner had helped me a lot, and he was a reasonably easygoing person, I believed all the success was contributed by me. There was only one way to run the company, and it was my way. When there was a likelihood of an argument, I made sure it became an argument and tried to win it regardless of the cost. I never began our meetings in friendly fashion and often talked down to him. I never considered his feelings, and even wondered why he wasn't more like me. In the end, I won all the arguments and had my way. But I lost the partnership, and subsequently, the company. After I learned this principle, I started looking back and now understand how wrong I was. I often think if I had known these things sooner, how different my business would be today. I know I can't change the past now, but I can see the mistakes I made and try not to repeat them. Today, this gentleman is a different person. Now, I always ask my partners about their goals before I set my own, he writes. Then I ask myself, what can I do to help this relationship lead to their goals? While it's easy to see why we want credit for successes for which we labored, claiming the credit will never win you friends. It will also diminish your influence quicker than just about any other action. What is the worst quality in a leader? Ask the followers, and they would tell you it is the quality of taking credit when things go well and dishing out blame when things go wrong. Few postures send a clearer, it's all about me message. Few messages send people scurrying in the other direction faster. Who wants a friend who thinks it's all about them? Who wants a leader who doesn't see your contributions? The answers to those questions are easy. Answering the opposite questions is just as easy. Who wants a friend who doesn't care who gets the credit? Who wants a leader who sees the full value of your contribution? Giving away credit is a magical multiplier, writes Forbes blogger August Turak, a former founding employee at MTV. It works equally well in business and in our personal lives, but harnessing this magic requires an attitude of gratitude. Without a sincere sense of gratitude, sharing credit is just another manipulative trick bound to backfire. None of this is rocket science. It's common sense. So why is credit stolen far more often than shared? The usual suspect is fear. But fear, in this case, should be reserved for the possibility of becoming a person who is afraid to share the spoils of success. Turak shares a homily he once heard that makes this point well. The Sea of Galilee is teeming with fish and life, the priest began. The Dead Sea is dead and devoid of life. They are both fed by the sparkling water of the River Jordan. So what's the difference? The Sea of Galilee gives all its water away. The Dead Sea keeps it all for itself. Like the Dead Sea, when we keep all that is fresh and good for ourselves, we turn our lives into a briny soup of salty tears. Surrendering the credit for a job or project can't be a false humility, a covert approach to seeking the spotlight. This is a form of the martyr syndrome. The principle suggested here is born not of attention-seeking activity, but rather of a supreme confidence that you are a far better person when those around you know they play an important role, not only in a collaborative success, but also in your personal success. Watch any film or music awards show, and you will see this dynamic in action, especially in the more magnanimous participants. What is the first gesture expected of the winner of an award? An acceptance speech. And what are acceptance speeches but a list of thank yous to those who were responsible for the winner's success? Some would argue this is merely standard show script, but those faces behind the names would have something else to say. As the camera swings to show these faces, all are beaming, some even crying joyful tears, sharing in the success and reciprocating the gratitude. It is perhaps no coincidence that Greer Garson, the woman credited with the longest acceptance speech in Oscar history at 5.5 minutes, is also the co-record holder with Betty Davis for the most consecutive Best Actress Oscar nominations at 5. Could it be that all that gratitude was a big part of the reason she was so successful? It's often said that to be successful, you must surround yourself with successful people. While there is truth to the statement, few see that there are two ways to approach this positioning. Either you can seek friendships with those who are already successful, or you can seek success for those who are already friends. Whichever way you choose, one thing is certain. Your success is always commensurate with the number of people who want to see you successful. But one way provides better numbers. When you seek friendships with those who are successful, there is no guarantee they will want success for you, too. You might have to work to overcome being perceived as a relational leech. On the other hand, when you seek success for those who are already friends, you can just about guarantee that these same people will want success for you. Surrendering the credit is a way of life you cultivate in your relationships because you are grateful for them and for what they give to you. It is nothing more than putting the success and betterment of others first, and putting your confidence in both who you are and in the rubber-like power of reciprocity. Mark Twain certainly possessed the former, and Henry Irving could not accuse him of at least trying to put confidence in the latter. There's an amusing anecdote about a conversation between the two literary contemporaries that neatly demonstrates this principle. Henry Irving was telling Mark Twain a story. "You haven't heard this, have you?" he inquired after the preamble. Twain assured him he had not. A little later, Irving again paused and asked the same question. Twain made the same answer. Irving then got almost to the climax of the tale before breaking off again. "Are you quite sure you haven't heard this?" The third time was too much for the listener. "I can lie twice for courtesy's sake, but I draw the line there. I can't lie the third time at any price. I not only heard the story, I invented it." Twain would have been happy to let the awkward irony pass without a word of the actual truth. Did it really matter to him that it was his story all along? No. He was happy to have the story play well for the good of the conversation. While Twain gave in at the end, and who could blame him, the funny story illustrates that it doesn't matter who gets the credit for a thing so long as that thing benefits all the parties involved. Inherent in the principle of surrendering the credit to someone else is this word we've already used, reciprocity. We don't give in order to get in a transactional sense, but we do give in order to foster relationships, and by doing so, we know there will be rewards. Reciprocity is a natural byproduct of a relationship where two people share in joys and pains. "Double the joy, half the sorrow," goes the saying. In true relationships, friends look for ways to repay friends. What would happen if this spirit of relating spread throughout a company, or a particular niche in the marketplace, or even across an entire value chain? Two things are certain. One, everyone involved would enjoy life a lot more. And two, success would be more probable as collaboration occurred naturally. We have more power to spread this spirit of relating today than ever. In the long run, no one but the originator remembers things such as whose idea it was, who spoke first, or who took the first risk. What people remember is magnanimity. It is an interesting paradox that the more you surrender the credit for something you've done, the more memorable you become, and the more you actually end up receiving credit. President Ronald Reagan was once quoted as saying, "What I would really like to do is to go down in history as the president who made Americans believe in themselves again." From this quote alone, we can establish a fairly accurate character analysis of the man. He was in the game so that others could win. His political goals centered on the uplifting and success of those he served in the office of president. Perhaps what best typifies Reagan is the quote on the plaque that sat above his Oval Office desk. It read, "There is no limit to what a man can do or where he can go if he doesn't mind who gets the credit." So often this is the case for influential people. They pursue a higher calling, something that transcends whatever political, bureaucratic, or success-oriented motivations stifle others. Reagan dismissed comments about his legacy with the quip that he wouldn't be around to hear what the scholars and historians would say of him. This is what endeared him to so many as a person and leader. He lived and led with a constant surrender to the greater good of a country, and did so with starkly unconventional methods. This is the mark of a person who seeks to elevate others despite himself. It is the unconventional mind that understands success isn't about attention and accolades. It's about partnerships and progress. Chapter 7. Engage with empathy. We already discussed the debacle surrounding Armando Galarraga's almost perfect game, destroyed by a gross umpire error on what should have been the final play. When you look at the replay, you see that Galarraga's face slips from elation to disbelief in seconds. The cheers of the crowd are interrupted by an eerie silence. Then loud boos and profanity ensue. Galarraga was needlessly robbed of what is considered the holy grail of pitching accomplishments. This is all the more maddening when you consider that the pitcher was not a superstar expected to reach such heights. He was an average journeyman who had accumulated an equal amount of wins and losses. This was perhaps his one shot at pitching prominence, and it had been spoiled. Who would blame him for lashing out at the umpire, crying out for justice? Even Joyce himself, after the game, said that if he were the pitcher, he would have been fast and fierce in the umpire's face. But there is yet another side, a third dimension to the story. More memorable than Galarraga's tainted perfection or Jim Joyce's subsequent contrition was the pitcher's response to the pilfering of his prize. His handling of the injustice engaged the entire world. In an ESPN interview following the game, Galarraga admitted he did not know what the call was going to be. He was just concentrating on catching the ball and getting the out. He admitted he was disappointed, but conceded that the runner might have been safe. He was both nervous and excited. The intensity of the situation meant that he had to rely on the calm judgment of the umpire. After the game, however, Galarraga viewed the replay and knew that a perfect game had just been taken from him. Yet somehow, when he spoke to the umpire, he was able to say, "I know nobody is perfect." He saw Joyce's contrition and knew he had a choice: beat him down further or see things from his perspective. The consideration compelled Galarraga to offer a hug to Joyce to make him feel okay. This was no camera-ready compassion. Galarraga was sincerely disappointed and sincerely empathetic. Throughout the post-game interview, he consistently responded to questions and the situation with the utmost nobility. He did not attempt to paint the umpire as a villain. He displayed humility and perspective, the progenitors of empathy. In an age bent on self-promotion and interpersonal leverage, we seldom take the time to consider how someone else might feel in any given situation. No one in the sports world would have faulted Galarraga for ripping the umpire on national television. Who would have whispered a word if the pitcher had used a featured interview as a platform to demolish Joyce's reputation? Yet Galarraga did nothing of the sort. His comments centered on how the umpire must have felt or what he must be feeling, and the acknowledgement that nobody is perfect. We marvel at this kind of reaction because it is so uncommon. Yet an intriguing and noteworthy point is that the young pitcher cemented a more memorable place in sports history for his response to losing the perfect game than he would have if he had achieved pitching perfection. Those who can find a way to engage others in a manner worthy of such distinction are on the path of significant influence. When dealing with a person, always ask yourself, how would I feel? How would I react if I were in his shoes? Cooperativeness in conversation, wrote Gerald S. Nirenberg, is achieved when you show that you consider the other person's ideas and feelings as important as your own. We frequently hear critiques of the world's leaders. It is easy, as the saying goes, to sit in the stands and solve everyone else's problems. What we rarely witness are people who say, "I can't imagine the pressure you must have been under to have the weight of an entire country on your shoulders. I can't imagine how much you must lie awake at night thinking through whether you made the right decision or said the right thing on national television." Once you take the time to consider the other person's perspective, you will become sympathetic to his feelings and ideas. You will be able to authentically and honestly say, "I don't blame you for feeling as you do. If I were in your position, I would feel just as you do." This phrase, so rare in discourse today, will stop people in their tracks, will immediately get their attention, and will make them far more amenable to your ideas. Most people are merely looking for somebody who will listen to them and be sympathetic with their plight, regardless of how large or small their woes. If you can do that for another, you are giving her a gift that will brighten her day, even her week or month. One man took a Dale Carnegie course years ago and reported how the special, genuine interest of a nurse profoundly impacted his life. Martin Ginsburg grew up poor, without a father, and with a mother on welfare. One Thanksgiving day, he waited alone in the hospital for orthopedic surgery. His mother had to work and couldn't be there for him. Loneliness was crushing him. He pulled the covers and pillow over his head and wept. Just then, a young student nurse poked her head in, heard him sobbing, sat on his bed, pulled the covers and pillow off him, and wiped away his tears. She told him how lonely she was, too. She had to work all day and couldn't be with her family. Then she asked young Martin whether he would have dinner with her. He agreed. So she went to the cafeteria and returned with two trays of Thanksgiving dinner. They talked and talked, and while she was supposed to get off work at 4 p.m., she stayed until 11 p.m. when he fell asleep. "Many Thanksgivings have come and gone since then," Ginsburg writes, "but not one ever passes without me remembering that particular one and my feelings of frustration, fear, loneliness, and the warmth and tenderness of a stranger that somehow made it all bearable." Today, there's little excuse for misunderstanding or overlooking another's perspective. Most of us are broadcasting the details of our lives, seeking significance or a sympathetic ear from anyone who will listen. By taking time to research other people's current circumstances, you will avoid making assumptions about them. If a person is important to you in some way, every second you spend trying to better understand his perspective is a second well spent. We are not empathetic creatures naturally, so we must work at it. Many elements can factor in to how we respond in certain situations: our upbringing, our faith persuasion, our economic status, or our current career status. These and more mix with our emotions to produce a mode of personal engagement with others. Yet, when we take the very things that personally move us and allow them to paint our perceptions of others, we move to a more influential place where our words can have significant impact. We would all grow in stature and confidence if we could learn how to celebrate the most common thread in everyone. Imagine the personal barriers you could bridge in your workplace, your home, or your friendships if you could always respond to mistakes and disputes in a gracious manner. What sort of treatment would you receive back? What sort of perception would others have of you? Remember, empathy is not a networking tactic to be learned and leveraged. It is a link to immediate affluence in human relations. It is Galarraga giving up his right to berate Jim Joyce and burning his name into the heart of every sports fan the world over. This is the undeniable power of a gracious, understanding approach. Chapter 8. Appeal to Noble Motives. We all crave transcendence, to be part of something bigger than ourselves, to be meaningful to the world and the people within it, to have it said of us that we rose above, took a stand, reached beyond, and did what was right and honorable and true. Small boys long to be the strong warrior or the heroic prince of an imaginary kingdom. Small girls long to be the clever maiden or the captivating princess at the center of a grand adventure. At a foundational level, these same desires are a reason you are listening to this audiobook. While relational improvement and business productivity are centerpieces of our lives, Their importance exists because we long to be people who make a difference. Tapping this noble motive in those who you'd like to influence can therefore reap great rewards. And it is likely simpler than you think. When the British newspaper and publishing magnate Lord Northcliffe found a newspaper using a picture of him that he didn't want published, he wrote the editor a letter. He didn't say, "Please do not publish that picture of me anymore, I don't like it." He appealed